Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The pandemic has changed so many aspects of our lives. Some people find solace during difficult times through their faith. That's what helped Nasia Ahmed. She's a practicing Muslim in Charleston, West Virginia.
In times of hardship, you increase your connection with God. You worship more, and that's where you get your strength from.
In this episode, we'll hear from faith leaders as they navigate reopening and keeping worshipers safe.
I just want the people of God to be healthy, and I want them to be spiritually cared for.
And we'll hear stories about sheep farming and ice hockey from the perspective of high schoolers.
Cool. But what kids really want to know?
What's the scariest thing to happen on the farm, and what was going through your mind?
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A lot of things have changed since we first heard the word coronavirus or COVID-19. Today's show is about resiliency in the face of change. We'll hear from several faith communities to find out what looks different and what they're resiliently holding on to and making a priority in their practices. And we'll hear from high school students who are learning resilience as they deal with trauma. We start today's show with an often important part of the religious community, singing. But not just any kind of singing. This type of music practice has survived for hundreds of years. Shape note singing is a sacred 300-year-old singing practice that has deep roots in Appalachia and the American South. Popular first in 18th and 19th century New England, shape note singing relies on a group of people doing basically, well, exactly what we're told we shouldn't be doing right now during the pandemic. People face each other in a square and sing. But for many folks in the shape note community, these times of isolation created an even stronger desire to sing. So what happens when groups can't get together in person? Inside Appalachia Folkways reporter Kelly Libby has the story.
Harmony is a defining feature of shape note singing, which is also called sacred harp. Not because harps are played, but because in this tradition, the voice is a musical instrument. This is from an all-day singing convention, an annual event with a potluck dinner, in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, which I first reported on in 2012.
The vocal style is unadorned and unpolished. The harmonic qualities of the music are striking. There's a lot of resonant chords that sound old.
Chris Wolf is a school teacher and sacred harp singer from Czech, Virginia.
You really see people shouting with joy and in the full experience of their grief and in the joy of being together in community. The tradition is like a sturdy enough structure that we can actually let go for a second and let our inner experience happen.
Shape note singing is not performance. Under normal circumstances, singers only sing for each other. That's apparent in the setup of the room. Singers stand in a square facing each other. And if you're in that square, you feel the music.
One of the beautiful things about shape note singing is that it has a capacity to hold like the full range of human emotion, great joy and despair, grief and ecstasy, longing and belonging. And it's often a balm in trying times. So it feels especially cruel that we can't sing together now.
They can't sing together now because of the coronavirus pandemic. They're practicing social distancing. When you're trying to prevent the spread of a disease like COVID-19, singing with a large group of people in an enclosed room is the exact wrong thing you can do.
So there's this acknowledgement that, yeah, that's what we have to do, but it really hurts.
Tim Morton is a documentary filmmaker and singer from Louisville, Kentucky. As someone who's practiced Sacred Harp for more than a decade, not singing was not an option. So Tim and his friends formed a virtual shape note singing. They invited anyone who practices Sacred Harp to individually record themselves singing the harmony part of a designated tune and to submit it to him by email.
Hi guys.
Tim combined the parts, which together approximate a kind of chorus, and uploaded the finished product to YouTube.
Hello.
The singer seemed timid and a little stiff.
All right, Rachel called 146.
But just like in real life, they start by singing the notes. Fa, sol, la, and mi. Says more than 150 people from 28 states and 13 countries, including singers from Appalachia, submitted videos of themselves singing harmony parts on this popular tune called Hallelujah. The words were written in 1759.
It says, "And let this feeble body fail, and let it faint or die. My soul shall quit this mournful veil and soar to worlds on high." This is where it really hits home, I feel like, is give joy or grief, give ease or pain, take life or friends away, but let me find them all again in that eternal day. And the chorus is, and I'll sing hallelujah, and you'll sing hallelujah, and we'll all sing hallelujah when we arrive at home.
The video has gone viral with more than 32,000 views. Tim says he never expected it to resonate with so many people.
Some of the like YouTube responses was like, I'm weeping, and I mean, even it actually, it kind of, excuse me, it's just, I can easily get choked up at times, but I think that the responses that I was getting were a big surprise to me, honestly. I felt like the experience that people had by watching it seemed, under these circumstances, something that really people were needing at that moment.
Tim says ultimately the video is a novelty project. That virtual singing just can't replace the experience of singing with a group of people in person. So Chris Wolf does the next best thing. Remember, he's the Sacred Harp singer in Virginia from the beginning of this story. Chris sings in real life with one person.
So, fa, fa, fa.
Chris and his wife Roxanne Greenberg are both part of a singing community in the nearby town of Floyd, Virginia. And they're both teachers. A job that became busier in the spring after classes moved online.
Just being able to sing a song for a minute and a half to 2 minutes, that does create some openness and some spaciousness and some rest.
In 2015, Roxanne and Chris were the first two singers in what eventually became a small group that met twice a month in Floyd. Roxanne says there's an intimacy that comes with singing with people and learning their personal stories month after month.
People like Chris and myself, you know, people who live together or people who are coupled, they can still sing together. And we have folks that we sing with who live alone. And so I wonder how it might feel different for them.
I have a home. What comfort this sweet sentence gives. I have a home in glory. Oh, glory.
Since Sacred Harp's beginnings, people have gathered regularly for what are called singing schools, where beginners can learn and longtime singers can practice. For newcomers especially, it can be hard to learn the songs. This recording I made in 2013 is from a typical weeknight singing in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I was actually a newcomer attempting to learn Sacred Harp. Chris says when their group got started, progress was slow going too.
In the beginning, when we were starting out, a lot of the folks who were coming to us, they weren't familiar with the tradition. And so we'd spend a lot of time just singing through the parts. Okay, now we're all going to sing the melody, and now we're all going to sing the alto. And it was kind of painstaking for someone like me who likes to go quick and move things along. It was kind of a process, and it really makes singing now all the more sweet. Roxanne says their group has attracted all sorts of curious newcomers.
Sometimes it's someone of an older generation that says, oh, I had a family member that used to do this, or I remember my dad and my mom or whoever, my uncle, doing it when I was younger, and I just wanted to hear it again.
Oh, Lord, give me a heart that's pure from base delusions free. Oh, help me every cross endure and always live to thee. Throughout temptations, help me stand when storms of death surround. Oh, keep me in.
Chris and Roxanne are singing an old tune called Markham. Roxanne says for her, it brings to mind the suffering and death happening because of coronavirus.
I know there's not on earth below can give me solid peace.
I think it's easy for us living where we live to be really disconnected from that. And I think sometimes words like this bring me back to the reality of what's actually happening.
Oh, then I will with patience walk.
With cases rising nationally, it's unclear how Sacred Harp singing communities in Appalachia will fare. Chris says it's unlikely the tradition itself will suffer, but that for now, what is suffering is a socially distanced community. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Kelly Libby.
Kelly's story is part of the Inside Appalachia Folkways reporting project. Hear more stories of Appalachian folklife, arts, and culture by subscribing to our podcast. More at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. There you can also see a video from one of the Shape Note singing gatherings Kelly recorded. Like the Shape Note singers, faith leaders have been forced to change their normal way of doing things during the pandemic. Some religious leaders are streaming their services online, while others have tried drive-up services where people can listen to a sermon from their cars. A time of struggle is often a time to lean on one's faith to keep hope. So it's no surprise to see so many creative ways to communicate and connect. Last month, as the economy began to open back up and small businesses began opening their doors, many churches, synagogues, and mosques reopened too. But this has brought new challenges, like how to enforce mask wearing, how to make sure people remain 6 feet apart. Emily Allen spoke with several religious leaders in West Virginia about the work they're doing to create safe spaces to meet in person.
Pastor John Wyatt in Raynell, Greenbrier County, had reopened his churches for 3 weeks when he got the news. The Greystone Baptist Church in Ronsevert, on the other side of the county, had a COVID-19 outbreak. On Wednesday, June 19th, the county health department said there were 47 active cases of COVID-19 linked to Greystone. Just like that, Wyatt says, he's back to offering virtual services.
Today, the church house is empty again because of the coronavirus.
You just don't know what to do. I mean, this virus is it's lurking out there. And I'm not being too overly cautious either.
All over the state, various places of worship are debating. Can they reopen safely with guidelines for social distancing and mask wearing? Or are the stakes too high?
You know, I'm not in this real huge hurry.
This is Reverend James Patterson from the Church of Nazarene and Institute outside Charleston. He hasn't met with his congregation for a Sunday morning service since March.
I just want the people of God to be safe. I just want them to be healthy. And I want them to be spiritually fed and to be spiritually cared for.
Patterson, who is Black, represents faith communities on a state task force for racial disparities in COVID-19. In that role, he says, he has learned Black West Virginians are disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Only 3.5% of the state's population is Black. Yet the Black population accounts for roughly 7% of the state's coronavirus cases.
So as a pastor, one of my main concerns is that why should I, you know, tempt fate and or tempt faith and expose people to a likely disease that could potentially kill them?
Reverend Jeffrey Canode in Alderson, Greenbrier County, says to him the situation is a matter of do no harm. Canode pastors 3 United Methodist churches around Alderson. He held one in-person service outside for the first time in 3 months, the week before the Greystone outbreak.
Certainly we understood that we needed to take a step back, and there was no question among the people that I talked to, the church leadership, that's something that we needed to do.
Canode's church is back to holding virtual services only.
After consulting with several leaders from all 3 churches, we came to the consensus yesterday that due to the outbreak...
You know, it was emotionally devastating, I think, for some people to have been back together and then to have to return to virtual worship.
David Johnston in Athens, Mercer County, still hasn't had an in-person service. Johnston is also a Methodist pastor at the Concord United Methodist Church. He says that he and church members miss singing, fellowship, hanging out after Sunday service. The type of things even churches that have reopened aren't supposed to be doing because they can hasten the spread of the coronavirus.
You know, at the end of the day, when you look at what we can't do and what we can do, I think what people are craving in getting back to church, we're not going to be able to do any of it anyway.
In South Charleston, Ibtisam Subarazi says the Islamic Association of West Virginia has resumed Friday prayer sessions at the local mosque.
So you can see we've marked the floor here, 6 feet apart.
It's not the same, she says. But it's an important step after weeks of virtual prayer.
We all are sort of like each other's family. Some of us been together for 30, 40 years in this area. And so this kind of family type connection that we feel close to each other is very important to us.
Like others, Barazi says her mosque was closed and they were conducting services over the internet from March to June. That included the entire month of Ramadan.
Normally, you'll see this place completely full in Ramadan with tables and worshipers who break their fast together. We didn't do that this Ramadan.
Barazi says they worshipped the whole month over the internet.
This Ramadan actually helped us refocus our thinking and worship and spiritual feelings toward the real religion, which is the worship and the connection with the Lord.
Catholic leaders in West Virginia reopened their churches on May 23rd for in-person services. They agreed to reopen with face mask requirements and social distancing. In Pocahontas County, a little to the east of Greenbrier, Father Arthur Bufagel says most people are adhering to the standards, but for his small rural churches, it has been an adjustment.
You know, in a big city in a church, a lot of times people really don't know each other, and hear our experiences. Normally, at the end of Mass, people just hang around, and generally people bring food, and we, you know, people chat and can go on for half an hour, an hour.
When people ask how long they can go on doing this, not sharing food, fellowship, singing, fully embracing their community, Father Arthur says he wishes he knew what to expect from this virus.
I hope we go back to normal. Sooner the better. But, you know, it's longer than I thought it'd be already. I think longer than most people thought it would be. So, you know, I can't predict.
There have been 7 reported church-related outbreaks in West Virginia since March. County health departments continue to track all kinds of locations and gathering points for potential community spread.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen.
Since Emily originally reported that story in June, some of the faith leaders she spoke with have gone back to in-person services or are considering opening back up later this month. September marks 2 important holidays for people of the Jewish faith, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Neither of the 2 synagogues in southern West Virginia have a full-time rabbi. Instead, they depend on traveling rabbis for these holidays. Tom Sofer is the president of Temple Bethel in Beckley.
It would be disappointing because we've conducted high holiday services at Temple Bethel since as long as I can remember, every high holiday service. And that's gone back, that's been a long time. And if it gets missed, I mean, yes, it is somewhat heartbreaking in one, you know, aspect, but, you know, it's a different situation right now.
Social media and technology are helping worshipers stay connected. Doris Sue Cantor, co-president of Ahavath Shalom in Bluefield, says her synagogue may have to stream pre-recorded services from Temple Israel in Charleston.
We've always had someone here for a high holiday, but, of course, we've never had a pandemic like this before either. But hopefully, if something, it wouldn't be the same, let's put it that way. But if we could Zoom and have services, it would be better than nothing at all.
As we heard earlier in our show, Muslims had to adapt their traditions during this year's Ramadan, the holy month for Muslims. But as we'll find out in this next story, not even the physical changes and all the new normals could hinder their faith. Back in May, reporter Kyle Vass went to one mosque in Huntington, West Virginia, and has more.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah.
Majid Qadr is singing the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. Qadr is used to large crowds because on Fridays, this room in his mosque can have hundreds of people crammed in shoulder to shoulder, all kneeling on the red carpeted floor, praying together. But today, the ornate red prayer carpet has a new pattern on it, white X's made from masking tape. These X's are set 6 feet apart to ensure people follow social distancing.
In normal days, we can have 250 to 300 individuals in the mosque, but now I guess the maximum we can have is 35.
Before Omar Atarabian could even set foot inside the mosque today, he had to put on a mask and have his temperature taken at the door. He's a professor from Jordan and attends services here at the Huntington Mosque. Today's prayer normally would be an hour long, but it's cut short to only 15 minutes in an effort to minimize potential exposure to the coronavirus.
We're slowly getting back to normal. As you see, we have to maintain a 6 feet distance between individuals who come to pray.
He says even though things are returning to normal, only having a fraction of his fellow congregates around feels strange.
The social aspect of the prayer, you know, seeing people, seeing friends, seeing, you know, people that you know every single week, which is a great thing, but now it's just different. We lack that sensation. We don't have the same thing.
The traditions during Ramadan were especially different this year. Most Muslims fast from sunup to sundown, so they look forward to the end of the day when they can get together and have dinner with their friends and family.
We used to have a community dinner. People, we used to invite people to come and eat.
Salim Salameh is standing downstairs from the prayer room, holding a handful of fresh-cut mint. He plans on using it for his early morning tea tomorrow.
But this year, I have basically I eat with my family. Even my son, he's live in Michigan, he said he wants to come. I said, no, stay where you are, because basically it's not enjoyable. Because the enjoyment to eat with people, you know, to feed people, to interact with people. But this one almost is gone.
But for some Muslims, the COVID-19 pandemic has given them a chance to get closer to God. Nazi Ahmed is a physician in Charleston, West Virginia.
In times of hardship, you increase your connection with God. You worship more, and that's where you get your strength from.
Ahmed says staying at home has given her more time to study the Quran with her children. According to Ahmed, the Quran reminds people to focus on the inevitable end of hardships like a pandemic.
There are various verses throughout the Quran which talk about, you know, how God will test you. Inna ma'al usri yusra. This is the sentence that with hardship is ease. Those who believe in that mighty power, we know that everything happens for a reason.
Unlike Huntington, the mosque or masjid in Charleston hasn't begun to reopen yet. And Ahmed says that the time away has made her love for the masjid stronger.
I know that we are all waiting. We have all learned to appreciate the masjid more because we haven't had it for so long, and especially in Ramadan. But, this pandemic, it has been unpredictable in many respects. I guess the next 3-4 weeks will tell us.
For now, Ahmed and her family will attend services online through the Islamic Association of West Virginia. She'll continue studying the Quran with her children and praying 5 times a day from home. As for the call to prayer, Ahmed says she can always listen to a beautiful adhan on YouTube. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Kyle Vass.
If you're Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, or practice another religion, how have you adjusted to social distancing during the pandemic? Has your church or house of worship reopened? Are you concerned about the safety of these gatherings? If it's something that's usually a priority in your life, are you being spiritually fed? Send us a note. Our email address is insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Better yet, record yourself using a smartphone recorder app and send us your 1 to 2 minute message, and we just may use it in an upcoming episode. Up next.
I was chased down by a steer one time, and I jumped a gate just in time for him not to get me with his horns.
The perils and perks of life on a sheep farm. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, an occasional segment here on Inside Appalachia where we explore how a place got its name. Today we're heading to a town that you might mistake for a peculiar or unusual town. We'll hear the story behind the town of Odd, West Virginia. Think you can guess how Odd was named? We'll have the answer after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
We're back. Curious for the story behind Odd, West Virginia? Our Southern Coalfields reporter Caitlin Tan has been digging into this to learn more about Odd and where it got its name.
The unincorporated town of Odd sits at a bend in the road that is also named Odd. There's a church and a post office. It's divided by a winding stream called Tommy Creek. It's in Raleigh County, about 20 miles south of Beckley, and only about 250 people live there, according to the last census count in 2010. Bubba Hope grew up in Odd during the 80s and 90s.
When I look at somebody and say, hey, my name's Bubba, oh, where are you from? Odd, West Virginia. You could imagine the type of looks I get. It, honestly,
It's a huge stigma.
But hope doesn't play into Appalachian stereotypes.
I'm proud of being from Ogg. Growing up in Ogg, nobody ever thought you'd amount to much, you know?
These days, Hope lives in Parkersburg, and he's the regional coordinator for Project Healing Waters Fly Fishing. Some of his favorite memories of growing up in Ogg include over-the-top Halloween decorations in his neighborhood and the snowstorm of 1996. That's when the railroad company his dad worked for helped dig the family out after they were stuck at home for 2 weeks. Hope loved how close people were while maintaining their independent streak, something he says still exists today.
You're remote, just enough to get away from a lot of people, so when you want the solitude, you got it.
But time and time again, people wonder, how did the town of Ogg get its name? On the West Virginia tourism page, it's featured as one of the most wild and wonderfully named towns. It's listed on Roadside America. Even the LA Times found the town noteworthy in their feature on West Virginia in 1985. Scott Worley, the historian for the Raleigh County Historical Society, says there's two documented theories on the name. They take place around 1900, and both involve the community gathering together to come up with a name to put on the post office, and also a mystery woman named Mrs. Brown. In one version, she proposed an idea, Worley says.
She said, well, you know, we want to stand out. We want our community to stand out amongst others. So let's come up with a name that's odd. And so someone said, well, that's a good idea. What name do you propose? And someone said, well, Ogg sounds like a good name.
And in the other version, she was reacting to the idea.
This Mrs. Brown said, well, that's odd. And somebody said, well, there you go. We'll just call it Ogg.
Over the years, the town drew residents for coal mining, railroad work, farming, and even jobs at the nearby ski hill. And as for Bubba Hope, well, he says no one living in Ogg was too preoccupied with where the name came from. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan.
That story is part of the Coalfields Reporting Project. Have you spotted a town with an interesting name and asked yourself, how on earth did they come up with that name? Send us a note and we just may go find the answer for you. We're at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Or send us an old-fashioned but still much appreciated letter. Our mailing address is 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Today's episode is about resilience and perseverance. Now we'll hear about a project that's meant to help students build resilience through storytelling and outdoor education. For the past couple of years, a group of high schoolers in northern West Virginia have spent one day a week outside during some of the colder months of the year. Yep, that's right. They were outside in snow and ice. It was part of a project called YURT, an acronym for Youth Resilience Training. The program prioritized the outdoors, mindfulness, food farming, and storytelling. West Virginia Public Broadcasting Assistant News Director Glennis Board, along with other educators, helped the students share these stories. Roxy Todd sat down with Glennis to hear more about the project.
So I started my education identifying what I was passionate about, which youth reporting, outdoor education, mindfulness, and most importantly, understanding trauma. So one of the most troubling aspects of my reporting over the years here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting has been discovering the extent to which kids throughout the state are coping with traumatic life experiences. It is a huge problem.
Wow.
Yeah. And this funny thing happened because I was exploring all of these passions that had seemingly no connection, youth storytelling, outdoor ed, mindfulness in the classroom, when it came to my attention in this profound life moment that what all of these things had in common is that they happened to all be effective therapies for traumatized individuals. So I got to work creating a program that combined all of these into one program, hoping to create a powerful community antidote to the trauma ravaging our region.
So you bought a yurt.
Well, it all started in 2018 with a 25-foot Western Plains-style teepee, which is significantly cheaper than a yurt. I worked with, and I've been working with Grow Ohio Valley, a nonprofit band of urban farmers in my neighborhood. They were engaged with Ohio County Learning Center, which is Ohio County's version of alternative school, which also happens to be in my neighborhood. And These public school kids at the learning center are deemed incapable of learning in a traditional environment. And we got permission to work with them. And so once a week for 8 weeks, we spent the school day together on this former derelict housing site that Grow Ohio Valley has repurposed and turned into a small working farm with grow beds and high tunnels and now a teepee. So imagine, we met there every week, October through December.
So you were in a teepee with these kids in the middle of the winter. What did they think about that? I mean, a lot of times it was snowing, right? And that was probably really uncomfortable.
Part of what motivated this entire program is this tendency that kids have today to huddle up inside and stare at screens. And they're becoming more and more disconnected from the natural world. And when you bring up like something like this, an idea like this, most people will say, oh, it's not feasible because the weather is bad. And these kids, you know, they expect their environment to adapt to them. That's where they are. And so we had to provide warm clothing and warm boots. And sometimes the kids could be talked into wearing them and sometimes not. They had to really sort of learn. It made me really nervous. It was like the one thing that I really wanted to test with the program. I just want to share this one story. I'll never forget the first day. It was supposed to rain and like sleet all day. The teacher in the class, he texted me early in the morning and said, why don't we just stay in half day? And I said, sink or swim, we got to test this and see what happens. And so the kids all trudged out. We had the teepee. We did have a fire. But there was a lot of work to be done, and it was all outside. They worked so hard. They were moving mulch. They were doing all of this stuff. They were in and out. They worked all day. They came in for lunch into the teepee, and I'll never forget, they were glowing. I mean, I expected them to be mad and disgruntled, but they were glowing. And the teacher, he came in to the teepee and he said, I just want to tell you guys, I have never been more proud of you than I am today because of the way, it's so hard for me to talk about this without crying, because of the way that you worked hard, you worked together, you figured out how to solve this problem and you made it happen and you accomplished something very cool. Human beings have been outside for 300,000 years, and it's something that we can do.
And then you bought a yurt.
Right. So this past year, this past school year, with huge community support, we extended the program and built a yurt. And my part now at Operation Yurt has predominantly been to teach mindfulness and storytelling. So we try to build connections with the kids and identify their passions. And then we invite experts from the community based on those interests to the yurt to be interviewed. The kids compile questions and help record the interviews. And then we'd work with them to tell stories with that material. It's great because we're meeting kids where they are on this really beautiful hidden site that, I mean, oh, it's just beautiful. There's this incredible view looking out over our community. And then people from that community join us. So kids learn a little bit about different professions, a little bit about how to tell stories. They get to express themselves. Baked into that, collaboration, critical thinking, creativity, critical 21st century skills. And West Virginia Public Broadcasting helps give them voice, which is so important. Research demonstrates that the power of storytelling is really not only in crafting a coherent and compelling tale, but also in actually being heard. And that is a really magical element that can start to address traumatized brain structure, giving people agency and positive self-identities. Now, of course, it's not a magic bullet. Really, we're just trying to highlight expertise found here in our communities and celebrate who we are.
After the kids were asked to share stories that interested them, student Bree Wiley wanted to know more about professional hockey. Bree worked with Corey Nollinger to share lessons of a professional hockey player both on and off the ice.
It's a hockey night in Nail City, Tonight, the WesBanco Arena is filled with fans waiting to see their minor league hockey team and Pittsburgh Penguins affiliate, the Wheeling Nailers, play against another team in the ECHL.
One of the names fans can expect on the ice tonight is defenseman Aaron Titcomb.
Playing ECHL hockey was a huge step toward a larger goal of playing for the NHL, but Titcomb says his goals are multifaceted and shifting.
At first, my goal was to make it to the NHL, and if that happens, that would be great. But now I think being able to affect as many people's lives as I can while I have this platform is my biggest goal, because when I tend to wear this jersey, people tend to listen to somebody who has this platform. So I want to take full advantage of that and show them that, hey, no matter where you came from or what your upbringing is, you can still affect a lot of people if you just put your mind to it and do it.
This is a lesson Titcomb learned from his own rough upbringing.
My father was murdered when I was one. He was shot. He got into drugs at a young age, and it kind of took hold of him. So I just kind of had a bad life. And my mother had to take the reins at the age of 17, so a single mother. Growing up in the city of Boston is kind of tough, so I kind of had a rough start, but my family came together. My mother really did a great job.
Growing up, Titcomb tried to play other sports, particularly baseball and football, but neither called out to him like hockey.
When he was 17, Titcomb's hockey career seemed to be on the rise. He had just verbally committed to his dream school, the University of Boston. It was the first year he was eligible for the NHL draft. But one moment changed his entire path going forward.
So I broke my neck when I was 17. I got hit from behind, snapped my C3 and C4, was deemed a quadriplegic, went into the hospital. I slowly started to get my feeling back. I was in a neck brace for 9 months. That's when baseball offers started to come in, and my mother's like, why don't you take the baseball offer? I'm like, no, hockey, something about it. I'm like, Mom, I'm going to play again. I'm going to play. They're telling me I can't play. That's kind of giving me fire.
The next 9 months were an uphill struggle for Titcomb, to say the least. Doctors thought he would have a hard time walking again, let alone skating. Even after skating, playing hockey wouldn't be easy.
Finally, after 9 months, Titcomb was to go on the ice again. He still remembers his first game back.
I remember it clear as day, because you got to think there's a lot of frustration that goes into that. Like, I couldn't even walk up a flight of steps without passing out because the concussion was very bad. I couldn't read a book without blacking out. In the first game, the doctor kind of says, like, okay, look, you're going to go and just kind of go through the paces. Don't really hit anybody. And I didn't listen.
Titcomb remembers getting at least 6 penalties that game.
I had a lot of built-up aggression. I actually ended up getting kicked out of the game.
Titcomb isn't at all apologetic about his aggression. He says there's a time and a place to blow off steam, and defending goals is one of them, especially hockey goals.
I think I just kind of built up a frustration towards the world and just a, you know, kind of like a why me attitude. And just, I think that got the best of me. And you know what, I don't feel bad for it, because I think anybody put in that situation, it would take a very special person to kind of just let it fly, especially with the life that I had before.
After high school, Titcomb ended up at Merrimack College, where he majored in sports management. It was there he made a connection with Merrimack coach Mark Dennehy, who had a very short stint as head coach of the Wheeling Nailers. During that time, he decided to sign Titcomb, who has since remained with the team. While Titcomb has lived a life of pain and persistence, he attributes his current success to one thing: his grades.
I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't be where I am without my grades, because my grades got me a college education. My grades are what's really gotten me here. So, I mean, hockey's just a luxury I have of playing. So without the grades, I wouldn't be able to do this.
Titcomb's story resonated with students, many of whom have had their own personal battles to deal with. Bree Wiley, an eighth grader at Tridelphia Middle School, was among the students inspired by the perseverance Titcomb has been able to show in the face of adversity.
He had so much that, so many obstacles in his path, like his father and stuff like that. And I just think it's really amazing how he can still stay so strong.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Corey Nollinger in Wheeling.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Bree Wiley in Wheeling.
So
Learning about a professional hockey player was really exciting for the students involved in Operation Yurt. But perhaps the story that got them most engaged was about two local sheep farmers. Jen Jensen collaborated with the students, helping them to interview farmers, and they put this story together.
So that's what wool feels like when it's still in the animal. I would have brought you a sheep, but...
We're here with Drew Manko, sixth-generation farm manager for the Ross Farm.
Maybe you guys can come up the farm.
They're specialty rare breed sheep produced in wool and lamb.
Can we, please, before I have to go?
Drew's mother, Amy Ross Manko, says the family immigrated across an ocean some 300 years ago.
Okay, so we came to America late 1600s, early 1700s, depending on which branch of the family you're talking about, from Scotland and Wales. And settled in New Jersey and then came over the mountains eventually and got to southwestern Pennsylvania about 1730. Of course, it's still Virginia at that point. And our five times great-grandfather's house was used as the county courthouse in our area.
Amy says the farm is all home to 11 breeds of heritage sheep, which are breeds that come from and have adapted to specific challenging geographic regions.
While steeped in personal and historic farming traditions, Amy explains modern farm managers like her son Drew are part of a movement of innovative farm techniques that both lean into the future and hearken to past practices.
So when I call my son innovative, it's because he's not sitting back saying, well, we just got to ship him to the auction because that's what Pap did. No. He's going out and seeking clients. He's processing himself. He's got a USDA processing number. He's providing the community with healthy, humanely raised, sustainable food.
Cool. But what kids really want to know?
What's the scariest thing to happen on the farm, and what was going through your mind?
I was chased down by a steer one time, and I jumped a gate just in time for him not to get me with his horns. We were loading him up to go to the processor, and he decided that maybe he didn't want to go.
Whoa. Sounds like a potential gore fest. Speaking of gore, Drew shared what turns out to be an amazing story about how his grandmother saved their livestock from a dog attack.
66 ewes were ripped up by not even wild dogs, somebody's dogs that lived near the farm. So my grandmother, who was a professor of nursing at WVU, stitched every single ewe back together. We didn't lose a single ewe, and they all lambed shortly following that.
Drew went on to explain some of his sheep are butchered and their meat sold. Others are bred for their wool. He's also talked about what happens to the wool after sheep are sheared.
We send it out to a family-owned mill in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they spin it into either yarn or roving and send it back to us, and then Mom goes to 10 or 12 fiber festivals a year and sells them, as well as we have a shop on Main Street in Washington that we sell yarn from.
Drew's mom, Amy, is what's called a fiber artist. She travels all over these days with her wool.
I started the yarn company in 2012, and then people asked me questions, and I figured out I better learn how to spin and knit because I didn't know the answers.
The Ross Farm tend to more than sheep. Drew also spent time showing students a few photographs of the retired Disney horses they now own.
And that's John when he worked at Disney World. Yeah, these two worked at Disney too.
Wait, what?
Mm-hmm. They worked for the mouse.
That's nuts.
Yeah, that's Gates again. He worked for Disney.
So all your animals are nice.
I try to. Yeah, they're friendly. If that's what you mean.
Animals are famous.
What they do for the mouse?
They pulled carriages.
Oh wow!
Yeah, you pick
yeah. For carriage rides. John actually pulled the trolley on Main Street. If you've ever been to the Magic Kingdom,
that's awesome. I've never been there, but that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right there, everybody.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for the young farmers who might just be starting out?
The main thing is don't give up. My generation has watched the turmoil that we've had in the '90s, early 2000s, where the prices are down, the inputs are up. They've watched their fathers and their grandfathers and their mothers and their grandmothers struggle and work a job or a second job as well as on the farm. And that's not something they want to do because they don't want to live like that. They don't want to struggle like they've watched their ancestors struggle. So the second they can get that, and it's that kind of, this is a small town, there's never going to be anything for me here mentality. So the second they're out of high school, they're gone. They're at a college, they're in a pipeline, they're doing something else. So don't give up. There's a lot of opportunities that the old timers either didn't see or didn't understand. Like niche marketing, direct to consumer, stuff like that.
Drew also left students with some heavy thoughts about farming to ponder.
He says his least favorite part, the hardest part about being a farmer, is the risk he has to take.
Any morning I could wake up and the place could be on fire and we would lose it all.
Despite hearing about scary encounters with bulls and dire warnings about risks associated with farming, students came away with respect and longing to visit the Ross Farm. Many aren't far removed from a time when farming was a normal, critical way of life in their families. And many experts in the field say returning to small farm models, which are still prevalent in this region, is the future. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jen Jensen in Wheeling.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ramon Gibbons in Wheeling.
This youth storytelling initiative was made possible through the Rural Arts Collaborative. It was recorded and produced out of a yurt in an outdoor classroom in the middle of an urban farm in downtown Wheeling. And if you didn't catch all that, learn more online at wvpublic.org. The pandemic is changing a lot of our world today. As we're forced to rethink our current habits, we're also adapting to a new reality. Without a certain level of resilience, how can we persevere? We just heard stories from high schoolers who had to persevere through snow and ice to pull it together. The students have suffered trauma, and only time will tell if they will persevere through life, too, in order to overcome that trauma. We also heard stories of traditions that have stood the test of time for hundreds of years, including the practice of shape note singing. It's no surprise to me that this practice has stood the test of time. Those voices together are powerful and evoke so much emotion as I listen. The songs tell a story and kind of demand your attention. In the beginning of today's episode, we heard how religious leaders are adapting to change and finding ways to continue helping people find solace and peace during the pandemic, because there is still a hunger by the faith community to be spiritually fed. It's not clear what those traditions, practices, skills, and knowledge will look like in the future, and what will persevere during this historical time. Thank you for listening and for sticking around so we can get through it together. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Folkways Reporting Project. Special thanks to the West Virginia Folklife Program at the West Virginia Humanities Council. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our music this week was also provided by Dinosaur Burps and Marisa Anderson. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Andrea Billups is our executive producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy also helped produce this episode. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.